Usually when we talk about a defensive strategy in sports, there's this built-in expectation of a fortress.
Right, exactly. Like a castle wall.
Yeah, you build a wall, the enemy attacks the wall, and your singular objective is just to repel them. You stay inside, you keep the gates closed, and you just try to survive the siege.
We definitely like things to be categorized nicely. Like we're on defense, they are on offense.
Right, it's a comforting way to look at the game, I mean.
It is, and honestly, it's how most of us are taught sports from a very young age. You either stop them or they score.
Yeah.
But the moment you step onto the ice in a hockey game, that static fortress mentality actually becomes a massive trap.
Because we're dealing with a transition landscape, right? It's entirely fluid.
Exactly. Operating at 20 miles per hour.
It is the absolute definition of chaotic geometry. Because, the moment you strip the puck off an opposing forward in your own zone, you aren't just on defense anymore.
Right, the siege isn't over.
Exactly. You're instantly tasked with organizing an escape while the enemy is literally still inside the walls with you. And that brings us to the mission of our deep dive today. We are taking a comprehensive masterclass on the ice hockey breakout.
The organized, deliberate exit from your own defensive zone.
Right. And the goal here isn't just to, memorize a few plays on a chalkboard. We are building a complete integrated mental model for you. So the next time you are watching a game from the stands or you step onto the ice for your own shift, you can read the play developing before the puck even leaves a player's stick.
The breakout really is the most fundamental transition in the sport.
Hi.
I mean, it happens constantly, shift after shift, period after period.
Yeah.
But if you watch amateur hockey or even disorganized professional shifts, you see it completely fall apart. And what's fascinating is that these failures almost never happen because a player lacks the physical ability to make a pass or skate.
Right, it's not a skill issue.
No, they fail for want of agreement. You end up with five players on the ice running five completely different plays in their heads, all reacting to the pressure differently.
And we have some incredible data to show exactly why getting this right is the difference between winning and losing. We're pulling from Corey Snadger's NHL tracking project, which manually logged roughly 230,000 zone exits.
Which is a massive sample size.
It's huge. And when you look at the numbers, they fundamentally change how you view the game. When a team executes a controlled exit, meaning they physically carry the puck over the blue line or make a tape-to-tape pass to a teammate exiting the zone, that leads to a subsequent offensive zone entry about 89% of the time.
Which is a staggering conversion rate. I mean, 89% of the time you are translating defensive possession into an offensive attack.
Right, but if a player panics under pressure and just flings the puck out of the zone into the neutral space, an unrecovered dump out.
Throwing it away.
Yeah, that translates to an offensive zone entry only about 20% of the time. You were essentially handing the puck right back to the team that was just attacking you, asking them to come try again.
The underlying philosophy here, which is completely supported by that entire data set, is that possession is the actual explanation for success.
Okay, wait, break that down for us.
So the method like carrying versus passing is secondary. Even a dump out that your own team manages to fight for and recover performs nearly as well as a controlled exit. The fatal flaw is losing the puck.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, leaving the zone where the puck is worth exponentially more than just flinging it clear because you got scared. You keep the puck by default. You only clear it if you have processed the defensive pressure and mathematically realized a clear is your only surviving option.
Wow. So by the end of this deep dive, you, the listener, you're going to know exactly what those options are, where to look, what vocal calls to make, the mechanics of catching a pass under pressure, how to read an opposing forecheck, and the incredibly specific rulebook nuances that govern this entire chess match.
And to start that chess match, before we can even talk about moving pieces around the board, we need to thoroughly understand the board itself. We have to map out the physical boundaries of the ice and the five specific roles your team is playing.
Let's start with the most critical geographic feature on that board. We all know the area in front of the net is dangerous, but the analytics show that turning the puck over in one very specific geometric zone is punished at a staggeringly high rate compared to a turnover just 10 feet higher up the ice.
Right.
So we need to talk about the house or the home plate area.
Yeah, visually it looks exactly like a baseball home plate, but the pointy end is resting directly on the center of the goal line.
Okay, so picture that on your head.
Right, the top edge runs horizontally across the ice, connecting the tops of the two face-off circles. The sides drop straight down the dot lines to the two face-off dots, which sit 44 feet apart. From those dots, the boundary angles sharply inward, tapering down to the two goalposts, which are only 6 feet apart.
And that specific shape encompasses the slot and the goal mouth. And the reason this shape dictates our entire breakout strategy is mathematical, right?
Entirely.
Yeah.
A shot taken from inside that home plate has an expected goal value multiple times higher than the exact same shot taken from outside that boundary. The goalie has less time to react, the angles are vastly worse for the defense, and the chance of a screen or deflection is maximized.
Which establishes the absolute golden rule of the defensive breakout. And we are going to repeat this a lot. You never, under any circumstances, move the puck across the ice in front of your own goal unless the read is unmistakable and the lane is completely empty.
Never. You do not try a cross-ice pass through the house. You do not try to skate it across the house yourself.
Right. If you need to get the puck to the far side of the rink, the highway is behind your own net. If you try to force a pass through the slot and it gets intercepted, your defense is moving the wrong way, the opposing forward has the puck on their tape, and your goalie is entirely at their mercy.
It's a point-blank scoring chance. Behind the net is safe. In front of the net is a minefield.
Okay, so keeping that minefield in mind, let's look at the five actors operating around it. The catalyst for everything is the puck retriever defenseman, who we will call D1.
This is the player who has to go deep into the defensive corners, or behind the net, to physically acquire the puck.
Right. And the technical execution of this job actually begins long before D1 ever touches the rubber.
The mechanics of the retrieval are everything. If you watch an inexperienced defenseman, they will skate in a perfectly straight line toward the puck in the corner, just staring down at it.
Yeah, tunnel vision.
Exactly. And if you think about the physics of that approach, by the time they arrive at the boards, their back is completely turned to the rest of the ice. They are facing the glass, they have zero forward momentum, and they are completely blind to the 200-pound forechecker who is currently lining them up for a hit.
They are turning themselves into a stationary target while wearing blinders.
Precisely. To execute this correctly, D1 has to do two critical things while they are still in motion. First, they must scan the ice by looking over their inside shoulder as they skate backward or transition to retrieve. You have to gather a mental snapshot of the pressure while you still have the time and space to formulate an exit plan.
And the second thing is the angle of approach. So instead of a straight line, D1 needs to skate an arc, curling into the puck's path. By approaching on an angle, your first physical touch of the puck happens as your body is already beginning to turn up the ice.
Yes, your hips naturally open toward the play. You can see the forecheck, you can see your passing options, and crucially, you haven't killed your momentum.
You're taking the puck to a decision point. You gather it and immediately move either behind the net or up the wall.
Right, the stationary defenseman is the one who gets hit, and the blind defenseman is the one who turns the puck over.
Okay, now D1 isn't operating alone down there. They have a partner, the support defenseman, or D2. And looking at the mechanics of this, D2 might be the most intellectually demanding role on the ice, even though they often don't touch the puck on the initial play.
D2 is the spotter. They position themselves on the opposite side of the net from D1, usually level with or slightly above the goal line.
From that vantage point, D2 has a panoramic view of the entire zone. Like, D1 is looking at the puck in the immediate corner, but D2 is facing up the ice.
Right. They can see the second layer of the forecheck. They can see a winger sneaking down the weak side. Because D2 possesses this vision, it is their absolute responsibility to be the vocal co-pilot. They have to yell the commands that guide D1's blind spots.
So they're the eyes in the back of D1's head. And there is also a fascinating physical aspect to D2's job. Let's say D1 scoops up the puck and decides to use their speed to skate it entirely around the back of the net, a play we call a wheel. D2 is standing right there in front of the net. So, you know, in American football, you have an offensive lineman throwing a block for a running back. On the ice, can D2 essentially act as that offensive lineman for D1? Can they just post up in front of the net and physically block the forechecker who is chasing D1?
Well, we have to be incredibly careful with how we define blocking here, because the execution of that physical obstacle is the razor-thin line between a brilliant defensive play and a catastrophic penalty.
Because of the interference rules, right?
Exactly. If we look at NHL Rule 56.1, the text explicitly establishes that a player is allowed the ice he is standing on. You are not required to magically teleport out of the way to let an opponent proceed.
Right.
You are always entitled to use your established body position to lengthen an opponent's path.
Okay, meaning if you get to your spot in front of the net early, plant your skates, keep your stick vertical and tight to your body, and don't throw an elbow or a shoulder when the forechecker comes past, you are a completely legal obstacle. The forechecker has to skate a wider, longer arc around you to chase your partner.
That is perfectly legal. You have stolen a half second of time for D1. But the massive caveat, and where amateur players constantly get penalized, is movement. The rule clearly states that moving laterally to make contact with a non-puck carrier is interference. If you slide 2 feet to your left at the last possible second to step in front of that forechecker, you haven't held your ice. You've delivered a pick.
And the rule books do not treat a pick as a minor inconvenience. If you think you're just going to sit in the penalty box for 2 minutes to save your partner, you are vastly underestimating the danger. The 2 minute minor is just the baseline.
Well, it escalates rapidly based on the vulnerability of the player you hit. A forechecker who is sprinting around the net, staring intently at the puck carrier, is considered a defenseless player. They aren't braced for impact. In the NHL, Rule 56.4 grants the referee the discretion to escalate that interference to a major penalty based purely on the degree of violence.
Wow.
And Rule 56.5 tacks on an automatic game misconduct if that major results in an injury.
And if we look at North American amateur hockey, it gets even stricter, doesn't it?
Much stricter. Under USA Hockey Rule 625, interference is a minor, but if you deliver that pick as a full body check to a defenseless player, the referees will immediately pull it out of the interference category and judge it under boarding, charging, or roughing. Under USA Hockey Rule 640 for roughing, recklessly endangering an opponent is a major penalty plus a game misconduct.
That's huge.
And Rule 602A allows for a match penalty, which means ejection and suspension for recklessly endangering any player, regardless of injury.
And Hockey Canada is similar, right?
Yeah, Hockey Canada is similarly severe. Rule 8.3 allows a major and a game misconduct based purely on the degree of violence, even if the player gets right back up, and makes it mandatory if there's an injury.
So the strategic takeaway for D2 is absolute physical discipline. Get to your tactical spot early, establish your feet, and hold your ground like a statue. A legal obstacle is brilliant strategy. A late lateral pick is a major penalty and an ejection. So that perfectly outlines the geography of our defensemen. D1 is retrieving with momentum and scanning. D2 is spotting, communicating, and holding their ground. The other three actors on our stage are the forwards. We have the strong side winger, or W1, who operates on the wall on the same side of the ice as the puck. We have the weak side winger, W2, on the far side. And we have the center acting as the low support pivot underneath the play.
And we are going to dedicate an entire masterclass to the biomechanics of how these forwards need to move shortly. Because if they aren't perfectly synchronized, the defensemen have no one to pass to.
Right. But before we move up the ice, let's cement the foundational rule. I want to ask you, the listener, a quick question just to make sure we're on the same page. What is the one place D1 should never pass the puck, and why?
Yeah, picture that home plate shape extending from the faceoff dots down to the goalposts. That space is off limits for horizontal puck movement. An interception there removes your goalie's reaction time completely. The entire architecture of the breakout is designed to route the puck safely around or away from that specific geometric zone.
Okay, so our five-man unit is set. The boundaries are drawn. The forecheck is bearing down on us. How do we actually extract the puck from the zone? This is where we open up the playbook. There are fundamentally 9 named breakout options, and they fall into 4 distinct strategic categories.
Right, the fast and safe plays, the evasion plays, the release valves, and the high-risk, high-reward plays.
Let's unpack those.
Yeah, and it helps to view these not as a list to memorize, but as a toolkit. You pull a specific tool based on the pressure the opponent applies. Let's start with the fast and safe tools. The most basic, fundamental play is simply called up. This is a direct, firm pass from the puck-carrying defenseman straight up the boards to the strong side winger.
It is the absolute fastest way to bypass the first layer of the forecheck. If D1 picks up the puck in the corner, looks up, and sees an open lane along the glass, they just snap it to the winger's tape.
And the mechanics of the pass are vital here. You are passing to where the winger's stick will be, aiming for the tape, keeping the puck flat. If you pass it into their skates, or worse, rifle it into the boards behind them so it bounces wildly, you've destroyed the winger's ability to transition smoothly.
But, you know, up is only safe if the lane is truly open. If the opposing team is running a system where their second forward pinches down hard on the wall, passing it up is basically handing the puck to the enemy right at the hash marks. And a turnover at the hash marks is instantly a high-danger shot. So if the wall is clogged, we need our second safe option.
That brings us to the D2D pass. This is when D1 passes the puck behind the physical barrier of the goal net to their partner, D2. on the far side.
And the strategic value of this pass is brilliant because it's not just about moving the puck physically. It is a mechanism for time theft. Let's really explain why that matters.
Well, when you execute a DDD pass, think about what the opposing forecheck is forced to do. They have committed their speed and bodily momentum to one side of the ice, trying to trap D1. The moment that puck slides behind the net to D2, the entire opposing unit has to stop, pivot, and skate across the entire 60-foot width of the defensive zone to reestablish their pressure.
Right. And while they're exhausting themselves skating laterally, the spatial dynamics completely flip. Every passing lane that was closed on D1's side is now wide open on D2's side. You have essentially bought your team 3 free seconds of unpressured ice. And crucially, because this pass goes behind the net, it completely obeys our golden rule of never crossing the home plate slot.
Exactly. Those are the safe plays, relying on clean passing lanes. But what happens when the passing lanes are blocked and D1 is under heavy physical duress? That's when we shift to the evasion plays, which rely heavily on manipulating momentum. The first is the wheel.
The wheel is incredibly fun to watch when executed well. It's when D1 decides not to pass at all. They scoop the puck up, activate their footwork, and skate tightly behind their own net, accelerating up the far side of the ice themselves.
But to successfully execute a wheel, a defenseman needs 2 specific conditions. First, they need foot speed. They have to know they can win a foot race against the first forechecker chasing them. Second, they need spatial awareness to know that the far side of the ice isn't already occupied by a second forechecker waiting to ambush them.
I want to highlight a really specific mechanical detail here, too. When D1 skates behind the net, they have to cut their route incredibly close to the goalposts and the back of the netting. If they take a wide, lazy, looping turnout toward the end boards, the forechecker doesn't have to follow their exact path.
Right, they'll just cut across.
Yeah, the forechecker can skate a straight geometric chord across that wide arc, essentially cutting the corner, and violently intercept D1 on the far side. By skating tight to the netting, D1 uses the physical structure of the goal, and D2, who is legally holding their ground, as a physical screen that the forechecker must navigate around.
It's using the rink's architecture to your advantage.
Yeah.
But what if D1 doesn't have the speed to outrun the forechecker? What if the forechecker is right on their hip, matching them stride for stride, trying to pin them against the glass? This is where we use the second evasion play. The reverse.
I love the reverse. I always compare it to judo, using the attacker's aggression completely against them.
That's a perfect analogy. Picture the physics of the interaction.
Sure.
D1 is skating rapidly up the half wall with the puck. The forechecker is hunting them down from behind, skating at maximum velocity, fully committed to delivering a body check or stripping the puck.
Yeah.
If that forechecker overcommits and their bodily momentum carries them even slightly past D1's hip, D1 abruptly banks the puck backward off the boards. They send it against the flow of the play, right into the empty space the forechecker just sprinted out of.
And the forechecker is traveling way too fast to stop on a dime and change directions. Their own kinetic energy takes them completely out of the play.
Exactly. They slide right past. But the reverse comes with a massive, non-negotiable caveat. When D1 banks that puck backward, they are passing into a blind spot. Yeah. They cannot see what is behind them. If they execute a reverse and no teammate is there to retrieve it, they have just blindly surrendered the puck behind their own net.
Oh, man. Yeah. Which means the reverse relies entirely on vocal communication. It only works if D2, or the center swinging low, reads the pressure, sees the open space, and explicitly yells reverse to D1. If you don't hear the call, you do not throw the blind pass.
Exactly. That covers evasion. Now let's address the panic scenarios. The forecheck has executed perfectly. Your passing lanes are gone, your momentum is stopped, and you are pinned against the boards. You need a release valve. The most common tool here is the rim.
Okay, let's clarify the physical difference here, because visually, a rim and a reverse look very similar. They both involve a player shooting the puck hard along the boards. Isn't a rim just a reverse?
Not at all. The distinction is entirely about the direction of flow. A reverse goes backward, against the grain of the play, punishing a forechecker who has flown past you. A rim goes onward, continuing in the direction the puck was already traveling.
I see.
You use a rim when a forechecker has sealed you off perfectly and is standing directly in your path, preventing any lateral pass. You essentially use the curved glass and boards behind the net to shoot the puck around the obstruction, hoping it squirts out to your winger on the far side of the rink.
So it's a desperation play, really. And when you look at the analytics, the rim is judged incredibly harshly as a strategic choice. We have tracking data from Daniel Weinberger looking at the KHL, which directly compared the success rates of rim passes versus direct up passes along the wall.
And the efficiency drop-off is severe. Weinberger's data showed that a direct up pass led to the team successfully maintaining possession in the neutral zone 53% of the time. When players used a rim, that possession rate plummeted to 38%. Rims consistently generate fewer expected goals and lead to more defensive zone time.
And if you break down the mechanics of a rim, it's easy to see why. The puck is traveling at high speed along the curved boards, often bouncing on edge. Your weak side winger has to try to corral this unpredictable moving target using their skates or stick.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Right. And they have to do this while an opposing defenseman is usually pinching down from the blue line, trying to crush them into the boards at the exact moment the puck arrives. You aren't executing a clean pass. You are intentionally creating a chaotic 50-50 physical battle and just hoping your guy wins it.
It is a very low percentage release valve, but there is an even more extreme release valve when you are completely outnumbered and physically exhausted, the glass and out. This is the admission that the breakout has failed, and your only goal is survival. You fire the puck high off the acrylic glass above the boards to clear it out of the defensive zone into the neutral zone.
You aim high off the glass rather than ripping it low because the friction of the glass slows the puck down. A puck fired low around the boards will often ruck it all the way down the ice. And if you shoot the puck from your own half of the rink all the way across the opponent's goal line, you trigger an icing infraction.
And icing the puck is a catastrophic outcome for an exhausted defensive unit. Let's delve into the exact mechanics of the hybrid icing rule, which governs the NHL and international play under IIHF rules. Historically, we had touch icing, where the play didn't stop until a defending player physically touched the puck. That led to horrific high-speed collisions into the end boards.
Right, the injuries were terrible, so they implemented hybrid icing to protect the players. Under NHL Rule 81.1, the linesman isn't waiting for physical contact with the puck anymore. They are judging a theoretical foot race.
Exactly. When the puck is cleared down the ice, the linesman watches the defending player and the attacking player sprinting after it. The defining landmark is the end zone face-off dot. Whoever crosses the plane of those dots first dictates the call. If the defending player wins the race, or if it is too close to call, the whistle blows and icing is enforced. If the attacking forward wins the race, the play continues.
And the punishment for losing that race and having icing called against you is severe. Under NHL and IIHF Rule 81.4, the team that committed the icing infraction is legally forbidden from making a line change.
And the physical toll of this cannot be overstated. You have five players who have just spent 50 seconds sprinting, battling in the corners, and desperately defending their net. Their lungs are burning. Their legs are filled with lactic acid. They clear the puck just to breathe. But because it's icing, the whistle blows, and the referee forces those same five exhausted players to stay on the ice. They now have to line up for a defensive zone faceoff against a completely fresh, fully rested line of opposing forwards.
Furthermore, Rule 87.1 explicitly prevents the coach from using their timeout to rest those trapped players. You are locked in a cage with fresh lions. It's a guaranteed high-danger situation.
There is a notable exception, depending on where you play. In USA Hockey, they generally allow you to ice the puck legally without penalty if your team is shorthanded killing a penalty. But even then, they recently restricted that exemption, so it only applies to older age groups, youth 15 only and older.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and we must also mention the other fatal flaw of the panic clear. If you try to go glass and out, but you miscalculate the angle and shoot the puck directly over the glass into the netting or the crowd without it deflecting off the boards first.
That is an automatic 2-minute minor penalty for delay of game. You go to the penalty box and your team is shorthanded, so the release valves are fraught with danger. Which brings us to the final category in our arsenal, the high risk, high reward plays, and the most famous of these is the stretch pass.
The stretch pass is the offensive home run. You have a winger who abandons their defensive responsibilities early. They slip behind the opposing defenseman and drift way up the ice, hovering near the far blue line. The puck-carrying defenseman in their own zone looks up, spots the cheating winger, and attempts to thread a diagonal 60 to 80 foot pass completely through the neutral zone.
If that pass lands perfectly on the winger's tape in stride, it is essentially a guaranteed breakaway on the opposing goalie. But the risk matrix here is terrifying.
It really is. If that long pass gets tipped, intercepted or knocked down by a forechecker in the neutral zone, the spatial geometry is suddenly lethal for the defending team. The opposing team transitions immediately into a counterattack, and your winger, the one who cheated up the ice, is now trapped 80 feet behind the play. They are mathematically eliminated from helping on defense. You have essentially created a self-inflicted odd man rush against your own goalie.
And even if the pass is accurate, the winger has to navigate the incredibly precise mechanics of the offside rule while traveling at high speed. This is arguably the most misunderstood rule by casual fans. Let's break down exactly what constitutes an offside play when receiving a stretch pass.
Yeah, the common misconception is that a player's entire body must be behind the blue line before the puck enters the zone. That is entirely false. Under NHL and IIHF Rule 83.1, a player is legally onside as long as one single skate is in contact with or behind the blue line at the exact instant the puck completely crosses the leading edge of that painted line.
Right, so you essentially just have to drag your back toe on the blue paint while your body and your stick reach forward into the offensive zone to catch the puck.
But the nuance gets even deeper, depending on which rule book you are governed by. In the NHL, they recently updated the rule so that trailing skate doesn't even need to be touching the physical ice. If your trailing skate is hovering in the air directly above the blue line or above the neutral zone, you are legally onside. They treat the blue line as a three-dimensional vertical plane that extends upward.
Wait, a hovering skate counts? That gives the winger an incredible advantage in keeping their speed up while stretching the defense.
It does. But if you are playing under North American amateur rules, specifically USA Hockey Rule 630A and Hockey Canada Rule 6.11, an airborne skate is ruled offside. In those leagues, the trailing skate must maintain physical, tactile contact with the ice or the blue line itself until the puck crosses. It requires vastly more bodily control from the receiving winger.
That is a phenomenal detail. Okay, the final play in our arsenal is the cross ice over. And we need to put a massive flashing warning light on this one because it deals with the lethal danger of team vocabulary. I'm going to group this so it's easy to remember.
Yeah, the word over is one of the most common vocal calls in hockey. But it can mean two entirely different things depending on the context in the coaching system. Let's conceptually separate them into Sense A and Sense B. Sense A is the cross ice over. This is a pass originating from the puck carrier on one side of the defensive zone, traveling across the entire width of the ice to the far winger, directly through the area in front of the net.
Which fundamentally violates the golden rule we established in the very first section. You're passing the puck right through the home plate slot.
Exactly. It is the absolute highest risk play of all nine options we've discussed. You only attempt Sense A if the opposing forecheck has completely overloaded one side of the ice, leaving the middle entirely vacant, and you have pristine vision of the lane. Because if a Sense A pass is intercepted, the enemy has the puck right on their stick in the high danger slot while your defensemen are actively skating away from the net.
It's terrifying. So what is the alternative meaning? What is Sense B?
Sense B is the safe D-to-D pass behind the net that we discussed earlier. Many goaltenders and defensemen use the vocal command over to mean the pressure is heavy on you, pass it over to your defensive partner behind the safety of the net.
Oh, wow. So think about this. If you are D1, your face is pinned against the glass and you hear your goalie scream over, you have a split-second cognitive crisis. Are they calling for the safe D-to-D behind the net, which is Sense B? Or are they telling you the middle is wide open and you should blindly execute the suicidal cross-ice pass in front of the net, which is Sense A?
If the five players on the ice have not explicitly agreed on what that specific word means before they leave the locker room, you have engineered a disaster. A defenseman might hear over, interpret it as Sense A, and blindly throw a pass into the slot directly to an opposing center. Precise, agreed-upon vocabulary is just as important as skating ability.
Absolutely. Okay, we have meticulously mapped the boundaries, defined the defensive roles, and unpacked the nine distinct ways to move the puck. But here's the harsh reality. The most brilliant, perfectly executed pass from a defenseman is entirely worthless if the forward receiving it is in the wrong position.
A pass requires a competent receiver.
Right. And this is where amateur breakouts instantly die. We need to transition into a masterclass on the biomechanics and positioning of the forwards. Let's start with the winger. What is the fundamental wall dilemma that plagues inexperienced wingers?
The most ubiquitous mistake a winger makes is standing completely flat against the perimeter boards, perfectly still, right at the hash marks, waiting for the puck to arrive.
They plaster themselves against the acrylic like a bug on a windshield. Why do they do it? Because it feels safe, If your back is glued to the boards, a defending player can't easily get behind you or between you and the wall to steal the puck. You feel like you are presenting an open, unblockable target to your defenseman. But the reality is that by doing this, you have rendered yourself entirely useless to the play.
You are uncoverable, but you are effectively paralyzed for three distinct reasons. First, you have zero kinetic energy. When the puck finally hits your stick, you are starting your acceleration from a dead, flat stop. Meanwhile, the opposing defenseman at the blue line is already skating toward you at full speed. You are going to get run over before you take your second stride.
Second, you have destroyed your own escape routes. Because your spine is against the glass, you physically cannot turn backward. Your only available path is straight up the boards, which is exactly the narrow lane the opposing defenseman is defending.
And third, from a pure physics standpoint, passing a puck to a stationary target, plastered against a flat surface, is actually incredibly difficult in a tight lane. The puck tends to bounce off the boards or get jammed in the player's skates.
So how do we rebuild the winger's mechanics? How do the professionals catch this pass?
It requires a complete overhaul of timing and body posture. Positionally, the winger does not start low on the wall. When the opposing team has the puck, the winger's job is to be high up in the zone, covering the opposing point man near the blue line. When the winger sees their team win the puck in the corner, that is the trigger. They time their descent, sweeping down the wall. The geographic landmark they're aiming to reach as the puck arrives is the stretch of boards between the hash marks and the goal line.
And the physical posture upon arriving at that landmark is the secret to the entire operation. As the puck is traveling up the boards toward you, you must aggressively open your hips to the center of the ice.
Your skates should be parallel to the boards, pointing up and down the ice, rather than perpendicular. And crucially, you want to take one or two distinct strides away from the wall toward the center. You want a gap of ice between your back and the boards.
By opening your hips and stepping off the wall, you achieve perfect panoramic vision. You aren't staring at the glass anymore. You can see all 85 feet of the rink's width. And by creating that gap, you instantly unlock four distinct options. You can use your forward momentum to skate the puck up the ice. You can thread a pass to your center, swinging through the middle. If the pressure from above is too heavy, you can bank a pass backward to your defenseman. Or, if you are completely swarmed by multiple players, you can employ the fourth option. You eat it.
Eating the puck means you accept that the breakout has stalled, and your only job is to shield the puck with your body to force a stoppage in play or a prolonged battle, rather than turning it over. You pin it against the boards with your skates.
But there is a massive safety protocol we need to discuss regarding shielding the puck. It's a matter of preventing severe spinal injuries.
This is a non-negotiable safety override. If you decide you have to shield the puck on the wall, you must keep your skates parallel to the boards. You drive your forearm, your hip, and your shoulder into the glass to create a brace. You keep your head up and your chin off your chest.
You never, under any circumstances, turn your back squarely to the boards to block the puck, and you never duck your head down near the dasher.
If you turn your back squarely to the ice, you are presenting your spine directly to an incoming checker who is traveling at high speed. You are inviting a boarding penalty that can result in a broken neck. Puck protection never justifies putting yourself in a structurally vulnerable posture. Parallel skates, shoulder contact, head up.
That perfectly covers the winger. Open hips, step off the wall, maintain momentum. Now we move to the center. If the winger is the outlet, the center is the engine. Their job is to provide low support underneath the puck, acting as a pivot point for the entire five-man unit. And the most common, infuriating mistake amateur centers make is what coaches refer to as the center fly.
The center fly is born entirely out of offensive impatience. The center sees their defenseman win a battle in the corner, and they immediately assume the team is going on a fast break. So they abandon the defensive zone prematurely. They fly up the middle of the ice toward neutral zone, hoping the defenseman can hit them with a 60-foot home run pass for a breakaway.
But by flying the zone early, the center structurally abandons the defenseman. D1 is down in the corner under intense pressure. They look up, and their only option is the winger on the wall, who is likely covered. The center, who is supposed to be the safety valve in the middle of the ice, is 70 feet away. The defense is trapped, and it usually results in a panic clear or a turnover.
The mechanical fix for the center requires discipline and a specific skating route. Instead of flying away, the center must execute a low support loop. As D1 retrieves the puck, the center swoops deep down into their own zone, curling inside the faceoff dots and dropping below the hash marks, curving toward the puck carrier.
The physical imagery that makes this click for me is a pendulum. Think about a heavy pendulum swinging down from its highest point. As it travels down the arc, it gathers potential energy. When it hits the absolute bottom of the curve, it is moving at its maximum velocity, ready to swing violently up the other side. That is exactly what the center is doing. By taking a deep, curved route that swoops down toward the goal line and then carves back up the ice, they gather kinetic energy.
That is a phenomenal visualization. The purpose of that deep curve is speed generation. Because when the pass finally arrives from the winger or the defenseman, the center catches it while they are already accelerating up the ice, facing forward exactly like the pendulum swinging up the other side.
Right. If the center just skates to a spot in the middle of the ice and stops to wait for the pass, they have killed their momentum. Catching the puck while standing still means they have to start their acceleration from zero while the opposing defense is already moving backward.
They have to arrive with speed, and there is a geographical boundary they must respect during this swing. The center must keep their route inside the faceoff dots, occupying the middle lane of the ice. If the center's curve drifts too far outside the dots and they end up near the boards, they are physically encroaching on the winger's territory.
You end up with two players occupying the exact same space, which means one opposing defender can effectively guard both of them simultaneously while the entire middle of the ice is left completely empty.
To synthesize this forward masterclass, wingers, you are not a statue. Start high, drop down the wall with timing, open your hips to the play, and keep your skates moving. Centers, you are a pendulum. Do not fly the zone early. Swing low beneath the puck, stay firmly inside the dots, and arrive into the passing lane with maximum forward momentum. If the forwards execute these mechanics, the defenseman will always have a viable moving target.
Let me just pause here to quickly review that for the listener because it's so important. Wingers, don't camp on the wall. Centers, don't fly early. Timing and momentum are everything, which is vital because we are going to need every single one of those targets. Up to this point, we've talked about our team executing plays in a vacuum. But there are five other players on the ice whose sole tactical objective is to ruin our day.
Right. The enemy gets a vote.
Yeah. We have to adapt our breakout based on the specific puzzle the enemy defense is presenting. We have reached the tactical chess match, beating the forecheck.
You don't just blindly pick a breakout tool from the arsenal. You select it specifically to exploit the structural weakness of the opposing team's shape. You have to read their pressure. Let's analyze the four primary defensive scenarios you will face.
Scenario one is the 1-2-2 forecheck. Structurally, this means the opposing team sends one forward deep to apply pressure on the puck, two forwards stay higher up to hold the middle of the zone, and their two defensemen remain back at the blue line.
The 1-2-2 is designed as a containment strategy. Its primary goal is to clog the middle of the ice and prevent you from easily executing that cross-ice D-to-D pass we love so much. But the structural trade-off of the 1-2-2 is that it gives you time. The first forechecker, F1, is usually instructed to steer you toward one side of the ice, not to aggressively run you over.
So as a defenseman, you exploit that time. You don't panic. You force F1 to make a definitive choice. You can initiate a wheel behind the net or simply skate the puck aggressively forward. The moment F1 commits their momentum to attacking you on one side of the ice, the geometry shifts. The other side of the ice mathematically opens up for a pass or a secondary lane.
But that time completely vanishes when you face scenario two, the 2-1-2 forecheck. This is a highly aggressive system, and it is the absolute default setting in most youth and amateur hockey. The opponent sends two forwards sprinting deep into your zone simultaneously, pressing incredibly hard on the puck carrier and the support defenseman.
With a 2-1-2, the containment is gone. They are hunting. Both corners of the rink are immediately covered. If you try to run a slow looping wheel behind the net, you are walking directly into a trap because that second forechecker is already waiting for you on the far post.
Because your time and space are erased, your decision-making has to be instantaneous. This is the exact scenario where the reverse and the rim become your most powerful weapons. Those two deep forecheckers are operating with a massive amount of downward aggressive momentum. As we discussed with the judo analogy, you punish that overcommitment. You reverse the puck into the empty space they just vacated.
Or if you manage to slip one quick, accurate pass past those first two forecheckers, you have fundamentally broken their entire defensive structure. Because they committed two guys deep, it means their third forward is left all alone trying to cover the entire middle of the ice. You beat the first layer, and suddenly you have a 3-on-2 rush going the other way.
Now, let's look at scenario three, which is structurally the polar opposite, the 1-3-1. In this setup, the opposing team sends one token forechecker slightly deep, but strings three players straight across the neutral zone like a picket fence, with one defenseman hanging back.
The 1-3-1 isn't really a forecheck, it's a barricade. It exists solely to intercept long passes. If you try to throw a stretch pass or any long pass through the middle, those three players will knock it down instantly. So D1 is standing behind their own net with all the time in the world, but absolutely nowhere to throw the puck. The counter tactic here relies on foot movement, not passing. You have to skate it out. A single token forechecker cannot effectively stop a defenseman who is carrying the puck up the ice with speed. When the puck carrier becomes a physical rushing threat, it forces that three-man wall in the neutral zone to react. They have to step up to stop the carrier, which breaks their rigid shape.
And once their shape breaks, you don't attack the teeth of the defense in the middle, you attack the width. You use very short, precise passes up the wall. You force those three middle defenders to constantly cross their skates and slide laterally to keep up with the puck, which inevitably pulls them out of position and opens up vertical seams.
Which leads us to the ultimate psychological and tactical test.
Yeah.
The control breakout. This occurs usually during a line change or a regroup when the opposing team abandons the forecheck entirely. They retreat and set up a rigid five-man trap in the neutral zone. You have full, unpressured possession of the puck behind your own net.
This is a staring contest. If you just let your forward stand still at the blue line while your defenseman slowly skates into five waiting opponents, you are committing tactical suicide. To break a set trap, you need heavily coordinated motion. The foundational rule of the control breakout is that the four players without the puck must move with speed to create cognitive overload for the defenders.
The defenders in a trap are playing a zone defense. They're responsible for specific areas of the ice. If you analyze Johnston and Walter's breakdowns of control breakouts, they highlight specific motion patterns designed to confuse those zone assignments. For instance, the blue-to-blue stretch. The center swings with massive speed deep behind the net. The support defenseman pushes out to the far corner, and the wingers stretch all the way to the opposing blue line. Suddenly, the puck carrier has four distinct moving targets at different depths of the ice.
Or they use the strong side slant. The center and the winger skate up the ice in parallel lanes. But right as they approach the trap, one of them slants aggressively inside, cutting across the other's path while the other stays wide. It forces the defenders in the trap to make a split-second decision about who to cover, often causing two defenders to collide or follow the same man, leaving a lane wide open.
The absolute key to all of these variations is constant high-speed movement. A control breakout executed with stationary receivers is just a slow, painful turnover waiting to happen. The receivers must dictate the pace.
So, active learning prompt for the listener here. Let's run a mental simulation right now to lock this in. Picture yourself in D1 skates. You are behind your own net. The puck is on your stick. You glance over your left shoulder. You see exactly one opposing forward gliding toward you with a wide stance. What is your immediate read?
Think about the momentum. One player gliding.
That is containment. It's 1-2-2. You have time. You can wheel around the net or carry the puck forward to force that single player to commit to a side. Now, reset the simulation. You look over your shoulder and you see two opposing forwards sprinting directly at you, sticks on the ice, pumping their legs. What is your read?
Their momentum is highly aggressive. Your time is evaporated.
That's a 2-1-2. You do not wheel the net. You use the reverse to bank the puck behind them, punishing their downward speed, or you execute a hard rim to bypass them. See? You are actively reading the ice geometry in real time. This is how the game slows down.
But just as you start to feel comfortable reading the players, we have to introduce the constraints of the physical rink and the rule book. Because hockey isn't played on an infinite sheet of open ice, it is governed by painted lines and complex penalties that radically alter the math of our breakouts. Let's shift to special situations, starting with a physical boundary that completely changes puck retrieval, the trapezoid.
If you watch an NHL or international game, you will see a distinct red trapezoid painted behind the goal net. It begins 8 feet out from each goalpost on the goal line, and the lines angle outward until they are 28 feet apart at the end boards. Under Rule 1.8, the goaltender is strictly forbidden from playing the puck behind the goal line if they are standing outside those painted lines.
If the goalie skates into the deep corner to retrieve a puck, they're handed an automatic 2-minute minor penalty for delay of game. The only minor exception is if the goalie manages to keep one skate physically touching the blue paint of the goal crease while stretching their stick out. But practically speaking, the corners are a legal dead zone for the goalie.
So why does this painted box fundamentally change our breakout strategy? because it dictates exactly where a defenseman is allowed to put the puck when they are under pressure. If you are D1 and you try to use a medium speed rim pass as a release valve, and that puck slows down and dies in the deep corner, you have created a disaster.
Because your goalie, legally, cannot leave the trapezoid to go get it for you. So your defensive partner, D2, has to sprint into the corner, turn their back to the entire ice, and dig the puck out off the wall while a forechecker bears down on them. It is a guaranteed high-danger turnover.
So in a league with a trapezoid, your spatial precision has to be perfect. You either have to hammer the rim pass incredibly hard so the puck travels entirely around the curve of the glass to the winger, or you have to intentionally decelerate the puck so it comes to a dead stop directly behind the net inside the red trapezoid. There, the goalie can legally stop it, trap it against the boards, and leave it perfectly placed for you.
The nuance here is crucial depending on what league you play in. Neither USA Hockey nor Hockey Canada utilizes the trapezoid rule. In North American amateur hockey, the goalie is completely free to roam. They can skate all the way into the deepest corner of the rink to catch a puck. In those leagues, a goalie with good puck handling skills effectively becomes a third defenseman who can execute a clean D2D pass for you.
But there is a massive behavioral restriction attached to that freedom. A youth goalie cannot just skate into the corner, dive on the puck, and freeze it with their glove to force a whistle. Under USA Hockey Rule 6-14C and Hockey Canada Interpretation 3 or Rule 10.1A, if a goaltender intentionally falls on or freezes the puck outside of the immediate vicinity of their goal crease, they are assessed a minor penalty for delay of game. They can play it with their stick, but they cannot kill the play.
It forces the puck to stay in motion. Now, let's analyze a situation where the structural math of the game changes entirely. The 6-on-5 breakout. We have two scenarios here that look identical on a score sheet.
Yeah.
Your team has 6 skaters and no goalie, and the opponent has 5 skaters, but they demand completely opposite strategic executions.
Scenario A is the delayed penalty. The referee raises their arm to signal a penalty against the opposing team. Because play doesn't stop until the offending team touches the puck, your goalie sprints to the bench and you send an extra attacker onto the ice. What is the absolute non-negotiable rule in this moment?
You never ever clear the puck.
It is the most baffling mistake in hockey.
It really is. Under NHL Rule 15.1, the play only stops when the offending team gains control of the puck. As long as your team maintains possession, you have a completely free, consequence-free 6-on-5 advantage. And mathematically, under Rule 78.5, it is illegal for the opposing team to score a goal on your empty net during a delayed penalty. The whistle would blow the millisecond they touch the puck to shoot it. The only way you can be scored on is if you accidentally pass the puck backward into your own empty net.
So the defensive risk is literally zero. Yet you will see panicked defensemen grab the puck and immediately dump it into the offensive corner. By doing that, they're willingly handing possession to the opponent. The opponent touches it, the whistle blows, and you just wasted a massive tactical advantage for absolutely nothing.
The correct strategy is supreme patience. You hold possession. You execute calm D2D passes behind your net. You let your goalie safely reach the bench, you let your sixth attacker get into their offensive formation, and then you collectively mount an overwhelming controlled attack up the ice. Now contrast that entirely with scenario B. It's the final minute of the game, you are losing by a goal, so your coach willingly pulls the goalie to get a 6-on-5 advantage to try and tie the game. You are pinned deep in your own defensive zone. Instinctually, a player might think, well, we have 6 guys, they have 5. We are technically on a power play. So if we get in trouble, we can just ice the puck down the rink to save time.
Right. That is a fatal misinterpretation of the rule book. The icing rule applies to a team that is equal or superior in numerical strength. Because you have 6 skaters and they only have 5, you are superior in numerical strength. Therefore, the icing rule applies to you in full punishing force.
If you panic and dump the puck all the way down the ice, the whistle blows for icing. And under NHL and IIHF rules, what happens to those 6 skaters who just iced the puck?
They're legally frozen on the ice. The rule preventing line changes after an icing still applies. You now have 6 completely exhausted skaters trapped in their own defensive zone, forced to take a faceoff, and you do not have a goalie in the net. The rules do allow the coach to put the goalie back into the net for the ensuing face-off, but your tired skaters are still trapped out there against a fresh offensive line. It is a tactical death sentence. Now, it's worth noting, USA Hockey doesn't enforce the bench freeze on icing, and Hockey Canada only does at elite levels. But the overarching truth remains. With an empty net behind you, any uncontrolled turnover is a guaranteed goal against.
Which means your breakout execution must be flawless. You cannot use a rim or a glass and out. you must execute a highly controlled exit. You utilize that sixth attacker as a low outlet option in the zone to give your defenseman a short, highly certain pass. You prioritize absolute possession over speed.
This is a tremendous amount of tactical and geographical information to process. We have mapped the zones, defined the mechanics of the roles, outlined 9 distinct plays, decoded the opposing forecheck, and navigated the severe penalty structures. But here is the crux of the issue. A hockey game operates at 20 miles per hour. A defenseman retrieving a puck in the corner doesn't have the luxury of pulling out a flowchart to run these calculations. How does a team actually process all this data instantaneously?
It entirely comes down to the efficiency of their vocal communication network. The eyes of the players are rarely looking at the same thing, so they have to share their vision. And the central hub of that communication network, the most important voice on the ice, is a goaltender.
Think about the geometry of the players. D1 is digging a puck out of the corner, their faces buried in the glass, looking at their skates. D2 is looking laterally. The forwards are looking over their shoulders. The goalie is the only player on the entire rink who is standing perfectly still, facing straight up the ice, with an unobstructed panoramic view of all 10 skaters. The goalie is the quarterback.
And because they are the quarterback, professional systems mandate a highly specific, universally understood vocabulary for the goaltender. The words must be short, sharp, and distinctly different in sound. If the goalie yells time, it is a command. It tells the retrieving defenseman that the forecheck is lagging. The defenseman has the luxury to turn their body, look up the ice, and formulate a plan.
Conversely, if the goalie yells man on, it means aggressive physical pressure is arriving immediately. It's a warning to the defenseman. Do not turn your body, keep your hips close to the boards, and prepare to protect the puck or take a hit.
And if the goalie yells leave it, it indicates that the goalie is going to actively intercept a rimmed puck behind the net and trap it against the boards, allowing the defenseman to swoop in and pick it up cleanly.
But the vocabulary is only effective if the timing is flawless. This is a critical psychological point. If a defenseman is skating toward the corner and the physical hit from the forechecker arrives at the exact millisecond the goalie screams man on, the call is worse than useless.
It induces total cognitive panic. If the auditory warning and the physical impact happen simultaneously, the defenseman flinches. They hesitate. The call must precede the pressure by at least a full second so the defenseman's brain can process the command and brace the body.
And the defensemen have a visual responsibility as well. When D1 does their over-the-shoulder scan before retrieving the puck, what exactly are they looking for? Because they don't have time to stare. They are taking a split-second snapshot. The instinct is to look at the forechecker's upper body or their stick.
Which is a mistake. The stick can be deceptive. A high-level defenseman looks exclusively at the forechecker's feet. The feet broadcast the player's true kinetic intent. If you look over your shoulder and see the forechecker's skates are gliding, meaning they're parallel and coasting, they're employing a containment strategy. They're trying to steer you. You have the time to initiate a wheel or carry the puck.
But if you look over your shoulder and you see their skates are actively striding, chopping the ice, pumping hard, they are fully committing their bodily momentum to a collision. That tells your brain instantly that their momentum is a weapon you can use against them. You prepare to execute the reverse to send the puck into the space they are aggressively vacating.
You are literally reading the biomechanics of the opponent to dictate your geometric escape route.
It is absolutely incredible. We have systematically decoded the chaotic matrix of a defensive zone shift. We've reached our final mastery review. How do we synthesize all these complex mechanical, geographical, and psychological components into a singular, cohesive mental framework?
The ultimate realization is that a successful breakout is never a pre-scripted, rigid play drawn on a whiteboard. It is the highly fluid reaction matrix. It operates in a specific sequence. D1 scans the feet of the forecheck to read the momentum. D2 and the goaltender process the overarching spatial pressure and communicate it verbally. The wingers and centers utilize precise timing and biomechanics to present themselves as moving, accelerating targets rather than stationary objects. And finally, the puck is routed safely to open ice, categorically avoiding the high-danger slot.
If we have to distill this entire masterclass down to an if-you-remember-nothing-else list, let's solidify the top 5 foundational principles for long-term retention. Number 1, the geometry of the house is absolute. Never, under any circumstances, pass the puck laterally through the home plate slot in front of your own net. Behind the net is a safe highway. In front of the net is a catastrophic goal against.
Number 2 is born from the analytics. Controlled exits, where you maintain possession by carrying or cleanly passing the puck out of the zone, are mathematically vastly superior to blindly dumping it out. The data proves that possession dictates offensive success. You hold the puck unless physical survival dictates otherwise.
Number 3. Wingers, fix your wall mechanics. Do not staple your spine to the acrylic glass like a statue. Start high, drop down with timing, open your hips to the center of the ice, and keep your skates moving to provide a dynamic target.
Number 4. Centers, you are the pendulum. Execute the low support loop deep inside the faceoff dots. Do not fly the zone prematurely and leave your defenseman isolated. Gather potential energy and arrive underneath the puck with maximum forward speed.
And number 5. Goaltenders and support defensemen, your vocal communication must be early, loud, and precise. And for the love of the game, before your team ever steps onto the ice, explicitly establish exactly what the word over means. Is it a safe pass behind the net or a lethal pass across the slot? That single piece of vocabulary will literally dictate wins and losses.
A team that adheres to those 5 principles will dismantle almost any forechecking pressure applied to them.
It transforms chaos into absolute predictable geometry. I want to leave you with a final provocative thought to mull over. We began this discussion by looking at Snagajour's massive data set. We know, as an empirical, mathematically proven fact, that maintaining possession and carrying or passing the puck out of the zone leads to vastly more offensive success than simply dumping it out. The numbers aren't close. It's 89% versus 20%.
Right, it's night and day.
So if the analytics overwhelmingly, unequivocally prove this reality, why do you think so many amateur and even professional coaches still default screaming, just get it out, off the glass, the exact second their team feels even mild defensive pressure? Is our inherent psychological fear of a defensive zone turnover actively holding back the evolution of the sport? Are we so deeply terrified of making a mistake that we refuse to execute the mathematically correct play?
Building on your opening metaphor, it all stems from the psychological comfort of the siege. Human nature dictates that people feel infinitely safer huddled behind a wall, indiscriminately throwing rocks over the top, hoping they land somewhere safe. It requires a tremendous amount of courage and discipline to deliberately open the fortress gates and march out into the chaos with a coordinated plan.
That is a phenomenal way to conceptualize it. The math demands courage. Thank you for joining us on this incredibly deep exploration of the game. Take this mental framework with you. Apply it the next time you step onto the ice or the next time you watch a game from the stands. Watch the feet, listen for the calls, track the momentum, and see how the chaos suddenly snaps into brilliant, readable geometry. We will catch you next time.